some of the challenges we faced forced us to do to design things in a very scalable way. So, you know, the older population, you know, we knew we could not rely on people to download apps and create passwords and all that kind of thing. And so we took a lot of the friction out that would, you know, you would normally encounter trying to stand up telemedicine. And so I think that kind of that combination of, the culture of the health system and just being thoughtful and about the design, you know, really kind of came together and allowed us to grow in a very rapid way.
From InterSystems, it's the Healthy Data Podcast. I'm Jordan Cooper. To learn more about this and other episodes, please visit podcast.healthydata.com.
We are here today with David Fletcher, Associate Vice President of Telemedicine at Geisinger Health System. David, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Jordan. It's a pleasure to be here.
Today, we'll be speaking about telemedicine at Geisinger. I think it's safe to assume that our listeners are well aware of, or at least would not be surprised, that telemedicine visits spiked significantly during COVID. Geisinger is no exception. In the past 4 years, Geisinger's telemedicine program grew 200 times previous volumes, with 500,000 telehealth visits during the height of COVID. At its peak, the health system averaged more than 3,800 encounters per day. David, I'd like to ask if you could describe how you went about overcoming the challenges associated with rapidly scaling up this program to meet patient demand.
Yeah, it was a huge challenge. And, you know, I'd love to claim credit for being having enormous foresight. but there was a little bit of, I think we were a bit lucky in that we had just transitioned to a single platform prior to that. So in the years before I started at Geisinger, it was, you know, kind of hit and miss. There were little pockets of programs. Some had been we're using one system and another we're using a different system. And so, you know, we had made the decision to really try to get it all on one platform. And so we have one platform that would do video into the home, hospitals, clinics, et cetera. And so we had done that, and it was still, you know, relatively niche product. You know, we had less than 1% of our visits being done via telemedicine prior to COVID. And we had a couple, you know, number of specialties that really focused on neurology and pulmonology and a little bit behavioral health. And then all of a sudden, you know, we had to immediately scale up, and we had, you know, we had to go from 20 specialties to over 70. We went from maybe a couple hundred providers to over 2,000. The fact that we kind of had the one platform, we had one process to use, was enormously beneficial. So we ramped up our training. We did all that, you know, at kind of, as you mentioned, really within about a month, we were able to get everybody on. And so we didn't have to rely on, you know, I know a lot of health systems, they had to kind of just use Zoom or FaceTime or whatever, you know, just to kind of get through. We stayed within our platform the entire time. And so we didn't have kind of a, it enabled us to more efficiently do our billing, and, you know, all the back end stuff was able to just continue apace because we were able to scale up so rapidly. And so we found that, you know, the great thing is a year or two into COVID, we had, you know, we're in central Pennsylvania, we had a snow day. And so we found the same thing. We were able to really quickly pivot and reschedule some of those in-person visits to video visits because we knew the clinic was going to be closed. And so we were able to show that we were able to decrease our no-shows that day by well over 1,000 visits, just from being that visits that otherwise would have been in person, we were able to convert to video. So once we kind of got that underneath our belts, we were able to continue to use that same process going forward anytime we needed a quick ramp up.
So speaking about unexpected challenges and adoption rollout, I'm wondering how telemedicine's role in relation to other departments has evolved within the Geisinger Health System over the past few years. And I ask because obviously if you're going from fewer than 1% of all patient visits pre-COVID telemedicine with a few hundred providers to all of a sudden this is de facto, I'm wondering if there's any politics within the organization, if certain departments are protective of their turf. How are you navigating all that? How did other departments, did they just embrace it? Were they hesitant? Were they resistant in keeping digital at arm's length? What happened there with internecine politics?
Yeah, that's a great question. Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, it was we had to start working with, you know, again, before we, it was almost kind of by definition, if whoever we were working with, they were doing it because they were interested in telemedicine and they had come to us and said, hey, I really want to do telemedicine. And so and it flipped after that. You know, now it's we're going to everybody, people who maybe telemedicine wasn't even really on their radar. And we're working with them now. You know, we were very lucky. Geisinger is, you know, kind of has innovation in its DNA. And so, you know, we had a lot of great partners on the operations side, but certainly the provider education and the provider experience is key. In fact, people ask me all the time at conferences, like, you know, how did you ramp it up so quickly? And a lot of it is the, you know, the patient experience, which gets a lot of attention and rightly so. But the key that I always tell everyone is it's equally important to have the provider experience because the providers really drive a lot of the adoption. So even in one of our specialties, I can see enormous variation from provider to provider. They're serving the exact same demographics, same target market. It's just that certain providers are really, you know, enthusiastic about it with their patients and others aren't. And so that's been really the big key is building in integrations. So our providers, they're in our electronic medical record all day. So we built in a lot of integration with the EMR so that it's very easy for our providers. And that has been key to getting uptake really throughout all these different departments.
In this podcast, we do have a very technical audience. Would you mind speaking about the actual technicalities of integration with your interface engines, how you are able to accomplish I know that Geisinger has a relationship with InterSystems, but more specifically, you know, how did you drive that provider experience? Did you have to rework workflows? How did you integrate those virtual visits into the electronic health record in their general workflow?
Yeah, absolutely. Great question. So the main key is we really push on our vendor partners and say, you know, if you come to us with a, hey, we got this great idea, you'll just log into this separate portal every morning. It's like that's basically a showstopper for me because everything has to really flow through our regular scheduling and EMR. So in our case, when we schedule a patient for either an in-person visit or a telemedicine visit, it goes through our EMR. We happen to be an Epic shop. And so we schedule an Epic. And then that automatically flows through. And so we've integrated with our telemedicine vendor so that they get that information. They send out the link to the patient and it's in the provider's schedule right in the EMR. And so there's no duplicate scheduling. We don't have to say, oh, this one's a telemedicine visit, go to the portal, schedule them for the telemedicine platform as well as in the medical record. And so same thing. And so some of the other types of integrations we have are when the patient has their visit, provider gets done documenting, then we have a way to automatically close that encounter at the end of every day because they don't have the front desk staff doing the normal pieces they would have. Well, and so David, that gets done automatically.
When you did encounter provider pushback, what were some of the rationales and how did you overcome those?
Sure. So, you know, it's been a mixed bag. Now, some of it is just the very legitimate of, you know, hey, there are elements of this exam that I can't do remotely. And that's, you know, can absolutely be the case. And so the thing that we've really been doing a lot of work on is pulling the data and trying to find out, okay, which visits, there's you know, one thing to, like the snow day example or the height of the pandemic, hey, we got to see the patients in some way. This is our only option. Now that it's kind of quieted down a little bit, the question is, what should we do going forward? And, you know, to what degree is it? Is it a patient, just a patient convenience? Are there instances where we see we actually have better outcomes? Or certainly if there are ones where they're worse, you know, we won't offer it. And so we've really actually worked with a lot of our providers to say, okay, what can you accomplish? And, you know, and I think it does vary just somewhat provider to provider. You know, some are very comfortable kind of thinking outside the box and saying, you know what, I don't really have to poke their stomach. I can ask them to do it and then, you know, tell what's going on, or, you know, depending on whatever their specialty is. And so we really make sure that the clinician has a strong voice in deciding what is clinically appropriate.
Have there been any surprises associated with the rollout and massive scaling of the program?
So I'd say, you know, one big surprise is just how much our older patients really have come to rely on it and like it. And I think, you know, going again, pre-COVID, talking about telemedicine and telemedicine audiences, you know, they'd always say, yeah, this is great for like the millennials and, you know, people born with a phone in their hands. But, you know, it's not really for the older patients. And we haven't found that to be the case at all. We actually, our satisfaction surveys, our older patients like it almost to the same degree as our younger patients. And I think part of the reason is that we very consciously designed our workflows to be very seamless. So as I was talking about for the providers, they're not logging into a separate portal. Same thing for our patients. We don't make them go through the EMR portal. We don't make them log, create a separate ID and password. If they're in our system, we just send them a link, you know, HIPAA secure link, and they click on that, they get right into the platform. And so we've had a lot of, we see in our survey, you know, responses, a lot of patients have said, I didn't think I'd be able to do this, but I actually really love this. This is so easy. And things that I would have never thought of. A patient said, you know, I have a brain tumor. And so getting on an elevator in your hospital, like, makes me sick every time. So being able to just sit in my living room, you know, that's a godsend. And so I think issues like that, you know, and transportation issues, et cetera. So we find that our older patients actually really love it. And it's really not a young person's tool at all.
I know one thing that you've spoken about is making telemedicine available to everybody, but in particular, you've actually, I mean, as you mentioned, counterintuitively, it's not just younger populations tend to be the early and more frequent users of telemedicine, but actually you're targeting a senior population and a rural population. Why? I mean, it's one thing to say we want everybody to come, but it's another thing to say we're specifically targeting seniors. Why is that?
Yeah. So a lot of it is just our demographic area. So we're located in central and northeast Pennsylvania, and it's not a rapidly growing area, and we're aging, and so it's kind of by necessity, you know. And in a way, it's been a good thing because it's really forced us to be very thoughtful about our processes and to be really intuitive and simple with the way that we roll things out. And so that's why. And we also have a very rural area. And, you know, same thing. It doesn't make sense to hire, you know, a super subspecialist, you know, infectious disease expert to sit in a small clinic in a very, you know, a town of 3,000 right. people. But we can get access to that specialist for everybody. And they don't necessarily have to drive. So a lot of what we do is in the home, but we also do things in the local clinics. So if you live in, you know, say Lock Haven, Pennsylvania, it's not a very, very big city. You don't have to drive 2 hours through the mountains to get to our main campus in Danville, Pennsylvania. You can drive a block away to your local clinic. They've got the cart and the peripherals, like the stethoscopes and things like that, that they can hook up. And so you can have a full exam with your subspecialist in many cases.
Got it. So how has Geisinger been addressing technical problems when the patient is unfamiliar with video conferencing technology, or if there's a lack of broadband connectivity in the patient's homes, as you mentioned, a rural small town, or a general lack of availability of peripherals such as stethoscopes and otoscopes?
Yeah. So, yeah, it's a big challenge. And I think, you know, part of how we've addressed it has been a little bit like I mentioned. So the clinic-based telemedicine is there for certain types of visits where it's like, hey, we need to be able to listen to the heart and lung sounds. So then, okay, home isn't appropriate, but we can get you your nearest clinic. Same thing if they say, I don't have broadband in my house, then we can say, well, can you get to, we see we've got a clinic, you know, a mile away from your house. Can you get to that clinic?
Got it.
So we host them there. Another thing is we've gotten a grant from the FCC for some to cover some broadband costs, and we hope that that will help kind of spur additional investment in broadband infrastructure, because it is certainly an issue. And my big worry is, you know, for the tools you talked about, and I think that is so important. It's not talked about often enough, I think, honestly. But ideally, you know, eventually people will have their medicine cabinets will have, you know, instead of just Band-Aids and things, it will also have like a digital stethoscope or something like that. And we could expand the pie of what we offer in the home that way. But my worry with that is, you know, and there are companies out there who do that, TidalCare and, you know, other groups like that, AMD. But if my worry is that if we start to rely on that without having some tools available to serve, you know, patients with lower means, does this become kind of a niche convenience for people of greater wealth? You know, and we really want to make sure that we are able to serve everybody. And so I think that's something that as an industry, we've really got to think about. And, you know, how do we either have these tools be very inexpensive? Do we have things like, you know, a community center that has them? You know, how do we make sure that it's not just a, you know, again, a niche convenience for people of means?
So you're alluding to your concern about how telemedicine can potentially exacerbate disparities if there's limited access to patients with broadband, which is correlated with socioeconomic status. Are there any other downsides to telemedicine?
Yeah. You know, I think so much of it is, you know, I think it requires a blend. And you know, and again, fortunately, like at Geisinger, that is one thing that we can always rely on, is that, okay, if you need some piece of some element of this visit that needs to be in person, we've got that infrastructure in place. We've already got clinics throughout our footprint and things like that. And I do worry a little bit about, you know, kind of some of the processes or programs that are just purely virtual only. Okay, then what happens when you do need some sort of service? So, you know, are you just going to kind of dump on the existing facilities that, you know, have built in all this infrastructure? So to me, like an ideal situation is a platform that has both options available, because there are going to be times you've got to have a blend.
What has been the impact on provider burnout, turnover, workflows, and a documentation burden, especially in the past few years? You've seen the Great Resignation. You've seen a lot of burnout, especially in the healthcare field because of the COVID pandemic. What's been the impact on those four elements?
Yeah, you know, it's been huge. And I think telehealth specifically, I think it has potential to help alleviate a lot of those issues. Now, it depends on how it's implemented. So if someone goes in and says, okay, telehealth, you know, maybe you can do this visit a little faster, let's increase your template, you know, by double, because, oh, you'll just be seeing patients over video, you know, that can be a problem. But I think by and large, it's helpful in a couple different ways. So one is, obviously, you know, we have some behavioral health providers who don't even have to be in a clinic for, you know, a whole day's worth of visits, because they've got so much. I mean, they do about 80% of their visits via telemedicine. And so that additional flexibility, I think, is very helpful for a lot of providers. And then also, it's very important for us. We here in Central Pennsylvania, it's a very rural area, and it's a beautiful area. A lot of people like to live here, but there are people who want to live in a more urban area and very hard to recruit here. But that becomes less of an issue, because we can have them, as long as they get a license in Pennsylvania, they can be anywhere in the country and see patients. Now we have to kind of bifurcate it out and say, okay, these types of visits go to you, these go to the in-person, you know, but I think it does have the ability to some of our access issues. We've really been able to help with telemedicine.
How have payers been responding to this shift in telemedicine?
Yeah, so that's been, I mean, the biggest key to the you know, the enormous explosion growth you talked about at the beginning was really the dropping of some of these restrictions that we've had previously, particularly with Medicare. And really a lot of the payers have kind of followed Medicare's lead on this. And so a couple of the biggest things that, you know, were barriers before were they said, okay, if you're going to have telemedicine be paid, it has to be extremely rural location. And by and large, it has to be a clinic. There were a few exceptions where they would allow it in the home, but by and large, it was in a clinic setting. And so they waived that during COVID. And so you can just see the enormous uptake that has resulted initially because of necessity with COVID, but now I think increasingly because really the patients are demanding it. And so right now, everybody is still kind of going with these waivers and largely things are being paid kind of to the same degree as in person. Still remains to be seen that the Congress, you know, put a 5-month extension beyond the public health emergency, that they'll continue to waive the rurality and the in-home restrictions. And then beyond that, you know, I think there's so much critical mass that we're hopeful that they'll continue to pay for it, but it's still up in the air to some degree.
How's risk sharing with accountable care organizations, shared saving plans contributed to, affected, or been affected by the influx of telemedicine?
Yeah, so that's a great question. It's a huge piece of the puzzle for telemedicine. And honestly, the number one reason I came to Geisinger about 4 years ago was because Geisinger has its own health plan. And so they also participate in an ACO. And I think those kinds of value-based systems lend themselves extremely well to telemedicine. And I'll give you one great example that we've had here, even prior to COVID, actually, as it was called the Geisinger at Home program. And it was funded by the health plan. And the idea is we would actually send nurses and community health assistants into a patient's home and help coordinate services for them. And if they had a concern, they would actually, initially, they would call a doctor. A doctor would physically drive to the patient's home. Now, obviously, you know, we want to scale that up. So we've added the telemedicine element to it. So the nurses go with a tablet and the stethoscope, otoscope, exactly like you described, and beam in a doctor. And so that kind of model, you know, doesn't make sense in a regular fee for service. It makes enormous sense for our health plan because we were in the first year alone, we were able to show $2 million worth of savings because those patients didn't have to go to the ED. They didn't have to get readmitted into the hospital, which is enormous cost for the health system. So I think, you know, just a great example of, you know, that value-based model lends itself really well to full population management, which telemedicine is a great tool to help enable.
Now, David, it's interesting speaking to you. Your program at Geisinger has actually been named the number one national telehealth network at the Telehealth Innovation Forum. What differentiates your program from myriad others across the country? What factors have contributed to the growth of telemedicine outside? I mean, what makes you so special? What's your secret sauce?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think it's a lot of things. I think, you know, partially it's, you know, as I mentioned, Geisinger has a long history of kind of innovation. And so we had a lot of partners that really helped us and everyone really got on board quickly. And then I think, you know, in a way, some of the challenges we face forced us to design things in a very scalable way. So, you know, the older population, you know, we knew we could not rely on people to download apps and create passwords and all that kind of thing. And so we took a lot of the friction out that would, you know, you would normally encounter trying to stand up telemedicine. And so I think that kind of that combination of, the culture of the health system and just being thoughtful and about the design, you know, really kind of came together and allowed us to grow in a very rapid way.
Well, David, I appreciate you answering that question. We are approaching the end of this podcast episode. I'll open it up to you. I'll suggest maybe any challenges with integrating data, with integrating workflows, with somehow balancing provider satisfaction with patient satisfaction, engagement, working with the operations team. I'll leave it up to you, you know, the challenges, the lessons learned in scaling up your program.
Yeah, absolutely. Great question. And I'm glad for this audience because it's not always the most front of mind, flashiest part of telemedicine, but honestly, one of the biggest challenges we've got going forward and we're working on right now is that kind of workflow integration issue. So like the way I always describe it is, you know, when you go into the clinic, what do? They hand you a clipboard with a stack of papers about this deep that you've got to sign and initial and do all that stuff. And a lot of that is, you know, informed consent type issues and, you know, sometimes maybe even signing up for a clinical trial and, you know, things like that. None of that was built in for a telemedicine visit. You know, we were mostly in the clinics and hospitals prior to COVID. So how do we recreate that whole experience and hopefully make it a lot more, you know, a lot simpler and convenient and tie all that stuff back to that same patient in their medical record? So a lot of that kind of work is needs to be done. And I'd say the other really big challenge, I kind of briefly alluded to it earlier, but is really understanding, okay, it's great. We've kind of showed what we can do, what's possible to do with telemedicine, but what should we do with telemedicine? And that's still an open question. And I work with a lot of my colleagues across the country and say, you know, what are you finding? And, you know, so for a long time, there was a real question of like, is telemedicine going to be a plus one? Are we going to do these telemedicine visits and then immediately have to follow up with an in-person visit because there were pieces of it that we couldn't do via video? Is this going to explode costs, explode utilization? I think that's what some of the payers initially worried about. And, you know, so we've done a big study of that and found that that was not the case, that actually you were basically just as likely to have a follow-up for an in-person as for video visit. So that was good. But then within specialties, which visits should you target? Are there downstream effects that we don't know about? You know, if you have your first visit via telemedicine versus your second visit, you know, all those kinds of things. I think there's just enormous data out there because we've had to do it for the last 2 years, 3 years. But now we got to really sift through that and figure out what's the optimal instances to do telemedicine.
Well, thank you. This has been David Fletcher, the Associate Vice President of Telemedicine at Geisinger Health System. David, again, I'd like to thank you for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Jordan. It's been a real pleasure.
From InterSystems, this has been the Healthy Data Podcast. I'm Jordan Cooper. Thank you for listening.